Wake up, America. Time to stump the experts. After a summer interlude, Information Please is back again. Presented by H.J. Heinz Company, makers of the famous 57 varieties. Information Please is presented under the supervision of Dan Golenpohl. And now, our master of ceremonies, book reviewer of the New Yorker magazine, Mr. Clifton Fadiman.
Thank you, Ben Grauer. We all feel very happy to be back on the air again and to greet our listeners with the hope that you've all had a pleasant summer. We offer our spontaneous and unrehearsed program as usual with our regulars, John Keir of the New York Sun and Franklin P. Adams, the stage of Western Connecticut, all set to go. Oscar Levant, who is our third regular, he's been working on a picture in Hollywood and wasn't expected in time for the program, but he'll be with us next week. Our guests tonight are the author of the best-selling novel, The Valley of Decision, Mrs. Marcia Davenport, and the eminent music critic, composer, and radio personality, Mr. Dean Taylor. Now, we're going to begin with a question from A.M. Rogoff of Brooklyn, New York. It's a fact of nature that men do odd things, do they not, Mr. Adams, for love of a woman?
Oh, boy.
And that's enough of that, Mr. Adams. I'm going to ask you to name for us a man in literature or the opera who, for love of a woman, did the following things. One who revealed a secret because of his love, was forced to reveal a secret. Mrs. Davenport.
Samson.
What secret did he reveal?
The secret?
I mean, unless it's something you don't care to speak about.
Oh, he told him that the source of his strength was his head.
Yes, that's quite right. And who wheedled the secret out of
him? Delilah.
Yes, the old wheedling Delilah.
Lohengrin reveal a secret?
Yes, indeed, he did. And what secret was that?
Well, who he was.
Who he was, yes. Mm-hmm. Who wheedled that out of him?
Elsa.
Elsa, yes. Mm-hmm. Same yeah, trick, just a different, different time and place. Yeah. Now, who, for love of a woman again, murdered her? Going to extremes, I think. Mr. Kieran?
Othello murdered Desdemona.
Yes, Othello.
Most foully.
That's quite right. Because he loved her too much.
That's right.
Too.
Not wisely, but too well.
Yes. And who in literature or the opera made a fool of himself for love of a woman?
Only in literature or opera?
Well, we want to limit the thing. This is a short program, Mr. Adams.
Cyrano de Bergerac.
Made a fool of himself for love of a woman. How did he do that?
Did a lot of foolish things, I think.
Well, that's a new plot that you just made up.
Wrote a lot of verse.
Well, that isn't so foolish. You've done the same thing yourself, Mr. Adams. Mr. Taylor?
How about the melancholy Jekyll? No, Touchstone, I mean.
No.
No, he was a fool.
He was a fool to begin with, yes. Mr. Well, Kieran?
No nomination.
I should think in Twelfth Night, the character Malvolio, because of his love for...
No, somebody else made a fool out of him. Maria and Sir Toby Belch.
Yes, but because he thought that...
Oh, he was very foolish.
What about that Hank of Hair boy?
Which one was that?
Hank Kipling's bone and...
A fool he was.
Fool there was.
Yes, that's true. That would be a very good one. Well, that gives us 2 out of 3. Anyway, how about this one from Lauren H. Johnson of Longmont, Colorado? This is a musical question, and we're going to call on a trumpeter to help us out. What incidents in opera are heralded by these trumpet fanfares? There are going to be 3 of them, and we're going to try to get 2 out of 3. Let's have the first.
Seventh Regiment.
Well, is Mr. Davenport?
What's the beginning of the military march in Faust?
Is that what you would say?
Yes,
Marcia.
Would you check for that to Mr. Taylor?
I don't think so.
It's been nice knowing you, Mrs. Davenport.
So I withdraw that. I'm not sure.
Well, I think it's from...
very familiar.
It's when the guard is changed in the first act of Carmen.
Oh,
at least that's the information I'm given. Is that right, Mr. Taylor?
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's something all 3 of us have learned, Mr. Davenport, Mr. Taylor, and myself.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That gives us 1 wrong and sends us on to the next trumpet.
They play it out of tune at the Metropolitan. That's why I didn't recognize it.
Very nice thing to say. Miss
Mrs. Davenport had her hand up almost at once, Emma.
That's in Fidelio.
Fidelio is quite right. What happens in Fidelio as after the...
That is just as Leonore has appeared. You know, she's rushed in to save the life of her husband, and the minister is coming, and they're waiting for him. That heralds the arrival of the minister.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. Very good.
It heralds the third Leonore overture, too.
Oh, you got it, too, after Mrs. Davenport had given you a little shove from behind.
No, but that's what the trumpeter does behind the scenes in the third Leonore overture, which is the overture to Fidelio, of course.
True.
Nevertheless, he does it.
True, very true. And now let's have the third of these fanfares. Mr. Taylor? What's so funny about that?
Nothing at all. Davenport thought she knew it, or thought I did. It's the march from Tannhäuser, the tournament of song.
Who comes in?
A whole lot of people.
What happens?
Thousands of...
whole company.
Minstrels and knights and things.
Knights, ladies, all the supers.
They have a sort of Olympic Games song.
That's right. Well, we did get 2 out of 3. You remember that, Carmen, next time, Mr. Taylor?
I sure will.
Pop up again on the show. And in case you should... here's one from Helen Dreyer of Fullerton, California. Can you recite for us at least 3 different lines from poetry or song which describe people who are overweight? Lines about fat people or plump people or... Mr. Kieran?
Hamlet. Oh, that this too solid flesh would melt.
Yes, very good. Mr. Kieran again.
The queen in Hamlet says of him that he will lose the bout with Laertes because our son is fat and scant of breath.
Yes. Now we've got the same man fat twice. Can't we shift to another man, Mr. Adams?
Let me have men about me who are fat and such as sleep all nights.
Very good. Yes. That's from what play, Mr. Adams?
J. Caesar.
Very good. Mr. Taylor.
Young Cassius has a half a lean and hungry look.
Yeah, but that is underweight, not overweight.
Well, I'd use it next week.
Mr. Kieran.
See how Falstaff sweats and lards the lean earth as he walks along.
That's a beauty, yes. Very good. Mr. Adams.
Mr. 5x5.
Stout-hearted man.
Those give us 5 or 6. The one with plump in it, Mr. Kieran, can you remember a line with the word plump in it? We've had too many fat, not
plump?
A single plump. Yeah.
Plump pudding.
Plump pudding, banish plump Jack and banish all the world.
And he says, I do. I will.
Yes. How about this from Mrs. M. Bradbury of Lynn, Massachusetts? Name the ingredient or seasoning which is treated in this way in the preparation of certain foods. In this case, the seasoning is sprinkled on and then washed off. What is that? And how, Mrs. Davenport?
Salt in pickling.
Yes, in pickling what, though?
Well, pickling cucumbers, making pickles out of cucumbers, or making any pickle out of raw vegetables. First they put a lot of salt on it, then they wash it off, and they do it again 4 or 5 times.
Now, what does that do to the salt? Discourages it, of course. salt on fish, too. Don't they do the same thing when they apply salt on fish?
Actually, when salt is... used for any, to preserve anything. You put it on, you take it off.
It all seems so futile somehow.
It's like an overcoat.
How about this? What ingredient or seasoning is cooked and then thrown away? Cooked and then thrown away.
Practically everything I try to cook.
Well, leaving out the tailor-made dishes, what other?
What is called a bouquet. A bouquet garni of herbs, which is a mixture of herbs in a little cheesecloth bag, which is cooked in soups and ragouts and is then thrown away before the dish is served.
That sounds very, very logical. I haven't got that answer, but I do have garlic down here. If you don't
mind. That's too easy.
Oh, yes, or soup greens or onions. Very often, that's the same thing.
Garlic isn't thrown away soon enough.
Check and double check on that, Mr. Kieran. Now, what ingredient in preparing a certain food is burnt off it? Burnt. It's burnt off the food. Mr. Davenport again.
The skin off of green peppers, when they're used in certain things, they're burnt so the skin will flake off.
Never
heard of it. Also with eggplants.
Never heard of it.
Well, in the Balkans, they make a dish with eggplants and they begin by burning the eggplant. When the skin is all burned off like a bad sunburn and thrown away, then they go ahead and make the eggplant.
Is that so?
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Kieran.
Brandy and a plum pudding.
Yes, that's the only one I would know.
Oh, yes.
I'm sure Mr. Davenport.
You don't want to work for us this winter, do you?
These are very utilitarian
pies. Try this one, Mr. Davenport and gentlemen. Get 2 out of 3 on this, too. This comes from Francis P. Rawlings of Seaford, Delaware. Give the names of the ladies, you'll find them in poetry, who could help in the war effort by answering these want ads. The first is, wanted, woman to join land army. Now, where would you find a woman in poetry who might answer such an ad, Mrs. Davenport?
Maud Muller.
Maud Muller, yes. What is the matter with you gentlemen this evening?
Didn't get the idea.
Didn't get the idea? I'll try this one, Miss Kieran. Maud Muller on a summer's day, rake the meadow, sweep with her. Yes, she'd be a perfect land army nominee. How about this? Wanted, woman to serve as an alarm clock. Where would you find her, Mr. Adams?
Queen of the May.
Yes, where would you find her?
Queen of the Way's mother.
The Queen of the May, mother, if you're waking, call me early.
Yes, your meter is a little wrong, but the general idea is correct. Mr. Kieran, do you want to...
Well, it's coming.
If you're waking, call me early. Call me early, Mother dear.
You must wake and call me early. Call me early, Mother dear.
Well, that's Mother who ought to be the alarm clock.
He meant the Mother, I think.
Oh.
Didn't you mean Mother?
Yes, the Mother of the Queen of the May.
Mother of the Queen of the May. And now, finally, wanted, woman to assist in Kaiser Shipyards. Woman to assist in Kaiser Shipyards. Mr. Adams.
Helen.
How do you make that out, Mr. Adams?
The face that launched 1,000 ships.
That's very good.
And first the topless powers of Aeon.
Very good, and that's 3 out of 3, and nice work, Mr. Adams. And now here's our Heinz reporter, Ben Grauer, with a meditative look in his eye.
I was just thinking that Schopenhauer described man's senses with a lot of wisdom when he said, sight has to do with understanding, hearing with reason, and smell with memory. For like an old family album, the aroma of good things cooking opens a door long closed on bygone days. You remember a kitchen warm with peace and security, and tempting aromas from kettles and ovens filled with the mysterious ingredients for eatables that satisfy the appetite and the soul. For over 74 years, H.J. Heinz Company has been dedicated to preserving these flavors of yesterday with food cooked to time-honored recipes and by time-honored methods. All Heinz 57 varieties are the kind of food that make a man mellow and expansive, make mealtimes an occasion. Nowadays, though you may find fewer of Heinz Keystone-labeled foods on your grocer's shelf, every one of them bears the same old-time promise of tempting, delicious flavor. You can count on it. And now a special announcement from Mr. Fadiman.
Thank you, Ben Grauer. The first announcement I'd like to make is that next week, Information Please will be the guest of the great city of Baltimore. We will broadcast there from the stage of the Lyric Theater. And, as is our fine old custom, we have gently persuaded every member of the Baltimore audience to pay his way in through the purchase of war bonds. So much for next week in Baltimore. The week following, we'll broadcast from Newark, New Jersey, again in the interests of the Treasury Department. And now for an announcement of extra special interest to every listener. During the third war loan drive, all questions that reach us, postmarked any time from September 9th to September 30th, and used by us any time during 1943, will be rewarded with a $50 war bond, not the usual $10 in stamps, plus the 12-volume set of the Junior Encyclopedia Britannica. And, of course, if your question stumps us, you get $57 in addition, plus the 24-volume set of the regular Encyclopedia Britannica. We may edit your questions a bit, and in case of similarity, you'll have to accept our judgment of who shall be paid. All questions remain our property. Don't forget, a $50 war bond for all questions used by us that are postmarked between the dates of September 9th and September 30th. And speaking of bonds, remember, the attack is on. Dig deep for victory. And now, back to the show with a question from Morris Feuerstein of Bayshore, New York. Suppose these people brought their difficulties to the domestic relations court. What would their problems be? Mr. McCorber's wife, what would her problem be if to Mr. Kieran?
Well, he took a drop now and then, the poor man.
Yes? Can you hail a man to the domestic relations court for imbibing too freely?
Well, I have no personal experience. I've never been hailed myself. I imagine that's one of the reasons it's set up.
Well, it might be one reason. I think there might be another, Mr. Adams.
He was also in a debtor's prison.
Yes, the failure to provide for his wife and family, I think, would be the technical charge that could be brought against him. And as I remember from my reading, David Copperfield, the domestic relations court would never have fixed up that situation at all. Do you think, Mr. Kieran?
It was fixed up all right in the end.
That's at the very end, but it needed Dickens to do it. How about Juliet's parents? Suppose they brought their difficulties to the domestic relations court. What would they be complaining about? The parents of Juliet. Mr. Taylor?
Why, she was obviously underage.
Yes, you sound as if you knew her, Mr. Taylor.
Well, yes.
You mean obviously? Yes,
well,
underage. And,
she was only 14 at the time of the play, and I knew her when she was 13.
Mr. Kieran, that would be quite right, wouldn't it?
Right, Bart.
And she married without the consent of her parents, of course. Nora Helmer's husband. Suppose he came to the domestic relations court. Nora Helmer's husband. Of course, we have to know who Nora Helmer is.
She's in the doll's house.
He is in the doll's house.
He is in the doll's house. And she's in the doll's house.
And what would his charge be against his wife?
Oh, his charge?
Yes.
Alienation.
No.
Desertion.
Desertion. Taylor, yes. His wife slammed the door and left him.
On grounds of his being a so-and-so?
Yes, more or less, roughly speaking. Well, that gives us about 2 3/4 out of 3. Try this one from Ernest E. Berglund of Leroy, Minnesota. I think we ought to get 3 out of 3 on this. It's not a very difficult one. What purpose is served by the long tail of a squirrel? What good is it to the squirrel? Mr. Kieran?
He uses it as a balance in jumping, that's all.
Well, that's enough.
Well, monkeys use the tail for some further purposes. That is, the New World monkeys, not the Old World monkeys.
The what? The New World ones? Are the newer ones than I've ever heard
of? No, they are
westernized.
Western Hemisphere monkeys have a prehensile tail, and the Old World monkeys do not.
Say, they ought
that's
to get
a good
together.
Thing to know.
That is a very good thing to know.
How to know a monkey?
Do you suppose Mr. Wilkie would ever be able to fix that one up? Yes, that's quite right. He also uses it, I understand, as a parachute and a rudder. Well, that's pretty much the same thing as balance, isn't it? How about the long legs of a stork? What are they useful for? Well, you've seen storks with long legs.
Well, the long legs of heron, which I'm more familiar with than storks, those are what we call wading birds. They belong in a great class of wading birds. And they walk along in the deep water, and fairly deep, over their toes, anyhow, yeah. And make a living by walking in that water
right.
And eating frogs and
right.
Tadpoles, fish, eels, anything they can pick up.
And they walk fast to bring children.
Matter of fact, isn't it true, Mr. Adams, that you keep an exceptionally long-legged stork in order to make it hard for you to reach the bill?
We have storks in our family.
How about this one? What purpose is served by the long tongue of a frog? Mrs. Davenport?
Doesn't it help him catch flies quickly on the machinery?
It does, yes. He catches insects, his food, with his long tongue. Try this from Wheaton T. Webb of Worcester, New York. Name the people of literature whose noses are described as follows. Now, there are going to be 4 of these noses. Let's get 4 out of 4. Who describes his nose as a giant turnip or a baby melon? Mr. Kieran.
Still, I'm not a baby melon.
Hey, you picked up an extra accent over the summer.
Yeah, that's a Gascon accent now. So is Serrano.
I knew we'd get that yet.
Matter of fact, Mr. Kieran, doesn't he go on to describe his nose and many other images?
37 lines of description, each line different, by himself.
One of the most famous noses in literature. He got his nose, as a matter of fact, throughout the entire second act. How about a nose like a cherry? Whose nose is so described? A nose like a cherry? Mr. Adams?
St. Nicholas.
St. Nicholas is right. Where would you find that nose?
In a visit from St.
Nicholas.
By Clement C. Moore.
Yes. His cheeks were like roses, his nose like a cherry. I'm the fellow with a great big smeller. Who is that? I'm the fellow with a great big smeller. Mr. Kieran?
Well, it sounds like Jimmy Durante.
Yes, it sounds like him, you say. Yeah, that's right. Jimmy Durante in his famous song, I Remember You. That's quite right. And who said this? If the nose...
had been a little shorter, the whole face of the world would have been changed. About whom was that said, and who said it? Mr. Taylor?
It was said about Helen of Troy. Oh, no, about Cleopatra.
Yes, you've got your gal friends mixed up this evening.
Well,
And who said it about Cleopatra, Mr. Taylor?
Oh, come now, my good fellow. I mean,
I think you've done enough for one evening. Mr. Kieran?
Oh, some cad. I don't remember his name.
I always say Walter Pater, hoping that someday I'll be right.
No, but it's a man whose name begins with P, Pascal.
Well, that's close.
Old cad Pascal said that about Cleopatra. Well, that gives us 4 noses out of 4, which is more than enough. Try this one from Ann R. Walder of Brooklyn, New York. Only one of you may answer this question, and you must get it all right. Name the order of surrender of the Central Powers in World War I. This is an exceptionally timely question. Give the order in which they surrendered. Now, I think only one of you may answer that, so I will select the one whose hand goes up first. I see no hand.
You have a lot of room full of armless wonders.
Mrs. Davenport, do you want to take a chance at it?
Yes, I'll put my neck out.
All right, begin with the earliest one.
I begin with Bulgaria, which went out first, and the Central Powers.
I read that, too. Go on.
I'm not encouraging, Mr. Davenport. I'm merely listening to you.
You're not making any kind of a sign at all.
Not a bit. No, this is an honest program. No.
Deadpan silence.
Austria-Hungary.
Keep going.
Turkey and Germany.
I'm sorry, that's wrong. Just a little wrong. Mr. Kieran, would you like to straighten Mr. Davenport out?
Well, I thought Turkey went out ahead of Bulgaria. I may be wrong about that. Then Austria-Hungary went out before Germany, of course.
That last part is right, but Mr. Davenport was right in saying Bulgaria, Turkey,
Austria-Hungary, and Germany.
Yes, that is the order. You had Turkey and Austria-Hungary in reverse, Mr. Davenport. Well, that said, $57 in war bonds and stamps to Mr. Waldo of Brooklyn, together with an Encyclopedia Britannica.
It's all right, Marshal. You're afraid.
And now here is that devoted follower of Epicurus, our Heinz reporter, Ben Grauer, with a palate-tempting suggestion.
The ancient Romans, famed for the variety and expert seasoning of their foods, are credited with the first widespread use of sauces. Good cooks today know that the wise use of a condiment such as Heinz 57 sauce can truly make a meal. In preparing this sauce, choice tropical and domestic fruits and vegetables, richly spiced, are patiently aged until every drop is rich with a flavor that's downright exciting. You'll find Heinz 57 sauce does double duty at your house. In the kitchen, you often will reach for this Keystone-labeled bottle to give enticing zest to gravies, rabbits, or meat salads. And if you're serving fish or hamburgers or scrambled eggs, by all means keep a bottle on the table. Make a note now to ask your grocer for this delicious, non-rationed condiment. Whenever your stews, leftover meats, and other wartime dishes need extra tang, you'll find Heinz 57 sauce is the quick, easy answer.
Thank you, Ben Grauer. Try this one for Mr. Joseph Barnes of Summit, Massachusetts. That's going to be a two-part musical question. I want you to name the supernatural villains of musical literature who sing these passages. There are going to be two of them. Who sings these passages? In each case, it's a supernatural villain. Let's have the first. Mr. Taylor?
Klingsor.
Who?
Klingsor.
Klingsor. Who is
Parsifal. Wagner's Parsifal.
Yes. So what's his profession?
Magician and general nuisance.
And what is he singing about?
He seduces knights of the Grail. I mean, he doesn't do it personally, but his...
His agent.
His agent, yeah.
The usual 10%.
Yeah.
and now the second of these arias. Mr. Taylor.
Mephistopheles and Faust.
Very good.
Serenade outside Marguerite's window.
Yes, that's 2 out of 2.
You see, when I like an opera, I know about it.
Yeah, but we can't have those two operas on the program every time. Try this one from Fred Leitner of Buffalo, New York. Here's an easy question. Let's get 3 out of 3 on it. Sing a line from a song which has one hi-ho in it. In other words, the phrase hi-ho used just once. Mr. Kieran.
Hi-ho, hi-ho,
That's
too high.
That is a pair of high hoes, a long time. Mrs. Davenport?
The farmer in the dell. Hi, how's the dairy? The farmer
good.
In the dell.
That would be a very good one. Now, Miss Curran?
Oh, well, I just had on one, and then...
Just had a hoe?
Had a high.
Mr.
Adam? Another one, high ho, says Rowley.
Yes, that's right. That's right. That has a single high ho. Now, two high hoes, Mr. Curran.
High ho, the wind and the rain from one of the Shakespeare's.
That's very good. Now, let's get on from one high ho to two high hoes, and that's the one that Mr. Curran gave us already. High ho, it's home from work we go. And now, how about a hay and a ho? This is a partnership, Mr. Curran.
One love. With a hay and a ho and a hay none in ho.
Very good. From what?
That's from As You Like It.
Yes. It was a lover and his last with a hay and a ho and a hay none in ho.
A hay none in none and a hot cha cha.
That's just a hay.
No ho.
Roger Johnson of San Mateo, California, sends this one in. What's the difference between whole blood and blood plasma? Whole blood and blood plasma. Mr. Curran.
Well, whole blood contains blood plasma plus the blood corpuscles, red and white. But the plasma is merely the fluid in which the red and white corpuscles are carried along.
That's quite right. And there's something else left out of the plasma, in addition to the fact that it's minus corpuscles, and that is something called platelets.
Well, that
and if we had lots of time, we could discuss what platelets are, and if I knew what they were, I could discuss what platelets are. How about the difference between iron and steel? Iron and steel, Mrs. Davenport.
Iron is what is made by the melting of iron ore, but steel is an alloy metal in which molten iron is combined with various different metals of other kinds in other forms, and those are cooked, so to speak, in various different types of furnaces, and the product of that is steel.
Are you an iron?
Iron is an element, and steel ain't.
Well, that's one difference. It's an alloy of iron with carbon.
Generally with carbon.
That's quite right. How about...
Oh, sure.
Don't argue with Mr. Davenport about iron and steel, Mr. Taylor. How about the difference between French and Russian dressing? Mr. Davenport.
French dressing is a thin dressing made with oil, vinegar, salt, and pepper, and a few other things if people are foolish enough to put them in. But Russian dressing is a mixture of mayonnaise and chili sauce.
Mayonnaise or a salad dressing with chili sauce added. Yes, I think that's right. Have you anything to add to that?
No, I was going to add Russian dressing.
Which do you prefer, Mrs. Davenport?
Depends on what you want to eat it with.
And what do you want to eat it with?
To get
Russian dressing with crabs or shrimp cocktail or something like that, and French dressing with green salad.
Oh, I just thought we might feed Mr. Adams up a little bit before this program is over.
Yeah, I don't need vinegar in mine.
That gives us three.
Yes, you do. You want Heinz vinegar,
Mr. Adams, and I guess that's all we have time for. Thank you, Mr. Davenport and Mr. Taylor, for starting our new series off with a bang tonight. Tonight, the H.J. Heinz Company has paid out $57 in war bonds and stamps, and that means one set of the Encyclopedia Britannica. Next week, Mr. Adams and Mr. Curran will be joined by the third of the Musketeers, the unpredictable Oscar Levant, and our special guest will be Congress's most charming member, the talented playwright and author, Representative Claire Booth of Connecticut. All of us will broadcast, as I mentioned before, from the stage of the Lyric Theater in Baltimore, Maryland, as part of the Information Please contribution to the great bond drive that we're all engaged in at the moment.